from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the program, the long and surprising history of artificial sweeteners. They weren't invented to help people lose weight. Also, classical singer Randall Scotting brings his high counter-tenor voice to Sacramento Opera. And the grassroots way two local filmmakers are raising seed money for their next movie. First, the controversy over smart meters. Utilities say these new generation meters help them and us manage power use more efficiently. But critics say the meters are intrusive, inaccurate, and might harm people's health. Joining us on the phone is one of the leaders of the opposition to smart meters, at least in California. He's Joshua Hart, founder of the group Stop Smart Meters. Joshua Hart, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me on, Jeffrey.
What first persuaded you that there is a problem or several problems with smart meters?
Well, the more I looked into this, the problems arose to do with these smart meters. You know, my girlfriend and I have been looking into the science with regard to EMF, electromagnetic field health impacts. And we've made the decision not to use Wi-Fi in our house, not to use cell phones, because there are some peer-reviewed scientific studies that show health impacts, and we choose not to use that. So when PG&E came along, we got this note in our mail, and they said, well, we want to install this smart meter. It's using wireless technology. We said, no thanks. You know, we don't want this. And they said, well, sorry, you don't have a choice. And we said, well, we were never asked about this, and now we're not getting a right to opt out. And as we learned more about, you know, the electrical interference that these things were causing, how people were getting bills sometimes four or five times what they normally pay, how PG&E and the government would be able to have information about what goes on in your house 24 hours a day, we were really horrified about this violation of the democratic process and corporate control over what's going on essentially in our homes.
So you had concerns about electromagnetic fields before PG&E said they were going to install a smart meter in your home?
Yes, that's correct.
Where do you live?
I live in Scotts Valley, which is in the Santa Cruz Mountains, here with my girlfriend, and we started the Scotts Valley Neighbors Against Smart Meters to let our neighbors know, to let the community know about the threat that these smart meters posed.
Specifically, what's the concern you have about electromagnetic fields? I know there's been a lot of controversy over this around the world for many years now, but as far as you're concerned, what is the science telling you?
Well, and you know, keep in mind, I used a cell phone 6 months ago. It was only 6 months ago when I got rid of my cell phone because of learning these studies. And you got to keep in mind that this is an issue that is very, very controversial at the moment. On the one side, you have a multi-trillion-dollar international industry, cell phones and wireless components, and that industry has a lot of interest in keeping things the way they are. And then you have health advocates who are concerned, and rightfully so, about an increasing number of studies that point to health impacts. For example, studies that look at heavy users of cell phones over the long term and that are not funded by the industry show a connection to brain tumors. And that is very consistent over these studies. Now, there's been a host of studies that over the course of the last several decades have shown that there are serious biological impacts from levels of electromagnetic fields, and this is, you know, microwave radiation we're talking about, the same technology that cell phones use, the same technology that smart meters use, impacts like DNA disruptions, breaches in the blood-brain barrier, and these are not, you know, wacko scientists. These are scientific findings that are published in peer-reviewed international journals, and this has raised the concern of enough governments that they've begun to take action. San Francisco in June passed the nation's first right-to-know ordinance that requires cell phone retailers to post the radiation levels on their cell phones so that consumers can just be informed about the risk they're taking. And Burlingame looks like they're following their lead.
Okay.
So there's been a tremendous response locally. Over 21 local governments, cities and counties throughout the state of California have demanded a halt to the smart meter program based on health concerns and these other issues. So this is something that is being looked at by our elected officials, by informed bodies, and they are making the determination that we need to have hearings and that we need a halt to this program pending those hearings at the state level.
Joshua, for the record, what's your professional background? Do you work in science or anything like that?
I've got my master's degree in transportation planning, so I am a transportation consultant and freelance writer. I really do not have a background in the science of this, but I've read, done a tremendous amount of research in the past 6 months trying to get up to speed. And really, I've had to drop my my professional career in transportation planning to focus on this threat, because I do feel like we are essentially under attack. PG&E has been lying about the impacts. They've been dishonest. And just recently, of course, in the front pages of the Mercury and the Chronicle last week, it was the news was broken that the senior director of PG&E's smart meter program, William Devereaux, was actually caught falsifying his identity and trying to spy on his opponents in a Public Utilities Commission legal proceeding that alleges health impacts. So,
and he has subsequently stepped down from his position. My guest is Joshua Hart. He's founder of the group Stop Smart Meters. We're talking about controversy over smart meters that PG&E is rolling out, and there are smart meters being rolled out in various places around the world. We invited PG&E to join today's discussion, but they declined. We also invited the California Public Utilities Commission to join us, but they have not yet made someone available. Joining us on the phone, though, is Robert Cleveland, who's a consultant on the health impacts of electromagnetic fields. Robert Cleveland, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Do smart meters generate a lot of electromagnetic activity?
You mean in the sense of energy?
Yes.
That someone could be exposed to?
Yes.
Actually, the studies that have been done show that the levels of exposure from those meters is far below worldwide safety standards, including those used in the United States by the Federal Communications Commission. So I would have to say no, they do not generate a large amount of electromagnetic energy.
And how confident are scientists and governments that those safety standards are good? Are they speculative, in other words?
No, they're not speculative. In fact, the international standards organizations have spent years studying this issue and reviewing literature and developing international standards for human exposure to electromagnetic fields. In fact, there's a list that I have of something like 25 or 30 statements from governments and expert panels from around the world concerning health effects and safe exposure levels. And they pretty much come to conclusions that are not really in agreement with what your previous speaker was saying. So I'd have to disagree with him on a lot of the things he was saying there.
He said that he's been studying writings by scientists, and he said, I think, something along the lines of, these are not wacko scientists, they're mainstream scientists, I guess. What's your experience of what mainstream scientists say about electromagnetic fields?
Well, I would say the mainstream scientists are saying that like I said, that the standards that we have are adequate and protect public safety. Now, there are certainly people and scientists in the scientific community who would disagree with that, but the standards organizations use what is called a weight of evidence approach to setting standards. In other words, we look at the hundreds of studies, thousands of studies that are out there, and then from the conclusions of those studies, use the weight of evidence approach to develop safety standards. And those are the ones we're using today. I worked at the Federal Communications Commission myself for 27 years in helping develop those standards that are used in the United States. And we spent many years researching this area and consulting with other federal health and safety agencies, such as the Environmental Protection Agency, the Food and Drug Administration. And those are the numbers and the values that we're using today. And with respect to the smart meters, the exposure is a tiny fraction of the safety limit, for example, recommended by the FCC.
Joshua Hart, Robert Cleveland, who works in the field, says that, yes, there are scientists who have expressed concerns about the health effects of electromagnetic fields. But he says that mainstream scientists say that the safety standards are appropriate. And certainly, in his opinion, the electromagnetic fields associated with smart meters are well within that safety range.
The first thing to understand about this issue is that international standards vary tremendously. So the United States has safety levels that are very, very high compared to other countries. For example, if these smart meters were installed in Russia, they would actually be illegal and they would surpass the safety standards there. The other thing to understand is that the FCC sets human exposure standards to electromagnetic fields based on thermal standards. So in other words, if it doesn't heat you, if it doesn't actually heat up your flesh, then it's not considered an impact. And we've seen impacts to our cells, to the DNA, to that cause cancer in the long term at levels far below what the existing FCC standards are. And an increasing number of scientists are speaking out, saying that these FCC standards are inadequate, that they need to be revisited, that we need to have biologically based standards, not thermally based standards, because we're not a hot dog in a microwave. We're human beings with living cells, and these cells are being impacted. And, you know, it's not just the science that is telling us that there's an impact from these smart meters. It's case studies. People have been writing to us from all over the state, telling us that they're getting headaches, they're getting nauseous and dizzy, and 3 to 4%.
But that's anecdotal, though.
Yes, it is. But 3 to 4% of the population is electrically sensitive, and they are many of them are suffering very badly because of these smart meters that have been put in without. Consulting the public. I mean, for example, a woman in San Clemente says that there's a sensation that the left hemisphere of her brain was actually being cut or splitting in two. The back of her skull feels electrified. The back of her tongue feels electrified. Electric shocks through her eyes, legs, and feet. A woman from San Diego writes in, it started with the aches and pains, the super dry lips, and the loud squealing in my right ear. Even my teeth hurt. Then the buzzing sound intermittently mixes with them. You know, there's a lot of these examples.
We get the picture. Robert Cleveland, do you want to respond to that?
Well, first of all, the standards are based on biology because the standards organizations, there are three primary ones internationally, spent years researching all the biological literature, evaluating the literature, and they weren't only looking at effects that were thermal effects. They were looking at effects of any sort and trying to decide if an effect was adverse or not. And if it is adverse, then to try to use that as a basis of setting a safety standard. And that's exactly what happened. So it was not as if all of the, the studies were cherry-picked or anything like that. Quite a bit of effort went into researching all of the studies. A lot of the studies that the other speaker is referring to either have had problems with the research protocol or the statistical methodology used, or else they were not able to be replicated by other laboratories, which is the test of science, is replication. And so there are quite a few questions about that. Now, you can also go to, for example, the World Health Organization, which has had a project for years looking into this whole area, and there's a very good website there at the WHO website concerning all of these issues with fact sheets of all sorts, including a fact sheet on electromagnetic sensitivity. So I would say the World Health Organization is a fairly balanced and has a very good reputation in this area, and they have pretty much come to the conclusions that I referred to earlier.
Thank you. Well, thank you both so much. Robert Cleveland is a consultant on the health impacts of electromagnetic fields, and Joshua Hart is founder of the group Stop Smart Meters. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
And again, we invited PG&E to join today's discussion, but they declined. We also invited the California Public Utilities Commission to join us, but they have not yet made someone available. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. When we come back, classical singer Randall Scotting brings his high countertenor voice to Sacramento Opera. Thank you. listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Not all higher-pitched voices in classical music belong to women. There are male voices too, and they're called countertenors. You often hear them in music from the Baroque period, including operas by Handel. One of those operas, Orlando, plays in Sacramento this weekend. It's a production by Sacramento Opera. The countertenor is Randall Scotting, and he joins us. Randall Scotting, welcome to Inside.
Hello.
Well, how did you decide to become a countertenor, or was this something that your voice decided for you?
Well, it's kind of a complicated question. I used to sing baritone, and a lot of people ask me, can you sing low, when they hear me sing the high voice? And yes, I can. And I started out that way and was singing along with the sopranos in choir one day and didn't really realize that was anything unusual, and mentioned it to my voice teacher, who sort of took me to a piano and started working with me and saw that I had this ability to work a higher voice, which I'll also mention all male singers have. It's called the falsetto range. And I just had the ability to sort of strengthen that and turn it into a usable voice, which is what I do now.
Well, when you were singing along with the sopranos, I mean, lots of people, guys, have sung along in a falsetto voice, but they're joking, and more to the point, perhaps it's painful. were you being serious about it, and did it hurt?
It didn't hurt, and I think I've always had the ability to sort of go up into that higher voice without a problem, and I think a lot of men can do it. I think more than the issue of it hurting them, I don't know how if it really does too much, but I think more it's a macho issue of wanting to try to sing like that and take it seriously. So
that wasn't an issue for you, obviously.
No. I started playing cello and was hearing the pitches, those higher pitches in my ear, and I think I didn't really build in a block that said, I'm singing along inside my head with those higher pitches as I was playing cello, and I just never thought, oh, those are high, I can't sing those, and then I just let it out, and there it was.
My guest is Randall Scotting. He's a countertenor singing with Sacramento Opera this weekend in a production of Handel's Baroque opera, Orlando. We have a recording of you singing in another production of Orlando, and the aria is called, and forgive me for possibly butchering it, Gialebro Mio Cilio. Has your voice changed fundamentally since you started singing professionally as a countertenor?
My speaking voice actually has gone up just a little bit. Old friends who I haven't seen in a long time, when I come back and see them, they're shocked at the difference, because I used to have quite a low voice. But that's sort of just healthy production in the way that you speak. So that may have happened if I was singing tenor as well, just, or baritone, I don't know.
What role do you sing in the opera Orlando, and is there any significance to the fact that that role is sung by a countertenor?
Yeah, I sing Orlando, so it's the name of the opera. That's my character, and there's these Baroque operas, when they're done now in modern times, there's the question of whether to go with a countertenor, like myself, or to have a mezzo soprano. It's the same vocal range, but it's more a question of believability. So Sacramento's opted to have a countertenor, because then you see on stage a man singing this part, and the roles that I sing, including Orlando, are more the heroic parts. And so then, Orlando is a soldier, he's a warrior who falls in love and ends up going sort of into the depths of insanity and coming back by the end, but love drives him insane. But mainly he's a warrior, so to see a tall, man on stage singing, even though it's a high voice, you have the believability of it being a hero. So I think a lot of people opt to do that now.
Orlando's at the Sacramento Community Center Theater, which is a very big theater, and this opera, Orlando, is a Baroque-era opera, so it's a smaller orchestra, usually. And it's just a more intimate experience. Mm-hmm. What do you think when you look out at the community center theater?
It's large. But I have to say, singing here in America, we have a lot of large theaters. I'm used to 2,000, 3,000 seat halls. So it's not too daunting. It's okay. Yeah.
So a lot of the countertenor repertoire is from the Baroque era, but there's more modern stuff too. Let's listen to a short excerpt from a piece by Benjamin Britten, who's an English composer from the 20th century, and it's called I Know a Bank. Is there a lot of modern repertoire for countertenors?
There's becoming more and more. Countertenors are becoming more of a known thing. I think even 10 years ago, you would be hard-pressed to find a countertenor studying in a school. There were just a handful of us that I knew about. And now, you know, there are a lot everywhere just because we have a lot more famous countertenors that are being recorded and outperforming. And so then that's sort of trickling down. So it's really a common thing to find, actually, and I think because of that, now there are a lot more composers writing for the voice as well. I sing music from 1950 and on, and then from the Baroque period as well, like Orlando. So,
Randall Scotting, he's a countertenor, singing with Sacramento Opera this weekend in a production of Handel's opera Orlando. It's at the Sacramento Community Center Theater this Friday evening at 8 and Sunday afternoon at 2. Randall Scotting, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, local filmmakers use so-called crowdfunding to help pay for their next movie. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. If you're a member of the Sacramento chapter of the Alliance for Women in Media, I'll see you at today's lunch meeting. I'll be chairing a panel discussion about economic trends and forecasts. Raising money is usually one of the big challenges when you're making a movie, even if it's low budget, but the internet can help. So-called crowdfunding makes it easier both to reach people and for them to make a contribution of any size. Two Sacramento filmmakers, Sarah and Paul Kreutz, who had festival success with Elsa Letterseed about a child prodigy who lost her talent, have turned to crowdfunding to raise seed money for their next film. It's a gothic ghost story called Gardner and Wells. I asked Sarah Kreutz, the film writer and director, why they thought people would click in a link and give money to a speculative film project.
We really believe in the product and our film project. I love horror films, but I really dislike the blood and gore that's out there right now. So I've set out to make my own horror film, and I think along the way I found out that a lot of people are turned off by the blood and gore too, and they just want something that's kind of spooky. So when they have clicked into the Kickstarter, they see our project, and I think they get really excited about the possibility of what the movie could be.
The Kickstarter being what?
Kickstarter.com is a website that helps artists of all kinds to gather seed funding for whether it be their first CD or a play or an independent film. And people can go on there and pledge various amounts and get rewards for that amount. And it's basically a group funding instead of one person contributing, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's a collective that you can pledge $5, $10, $15. And the idea is that many people pledge the amount and give these artists their funds.
And Paul, yes. The goal was actually reached just a couple of days ago, wasn't it?
In fact, we exceeded the goal. Yeah, we reached the goal, I think it was about 4 days prior to the end of our campaign. So we were really excited that we went over the goal.
The goal was?
The goal was 12,500.
And what did you end up with, or what are you at right now?
Well, we ended up at 13,250.
And so what happens to the extra money? Is that gravy, or is that returned to people, or what?
No, that's actually you can go over by whatever amount. There are some campaigns that have gone 200 and some percent over what their first goal was.
So there's no ceiling, but there is a floor, Sarah, because if you hadn't made the goal, what happens to the pledges?
We get zero, and everyone else, their credit card does not get charged.
So you must have been quite relieved when you saw that you made the goal and exceeded it.
Very much so.
We're talking about the way the film, an independent film called Gardner and Wells, a Gothic ghost story being shot in the Sacramento area, is being funded. People are basically have been making pledges, and so long as enough money comes in, that provides the money to help make the film happen. Sarah, what percentage of the total budget is this $12,500 that was the goal?
You want me to do math really quick in my head? No, it's a very small percentage, and I would say probably about 5% of our entire budget. But basically, this is seed money to get an interactive website up, to get a promo trailer together, and also for marketing materials to get the larger funds that we need.
So you don't have the other funds yet. This money is to help you get started in that process.
No, we're taking extremely baby steps to continue the momentum and get to our final goal.
So, Paul, how long do you think it's going to take to get the money that is really needed in total to actually make the film?
Oh, boy. Well, it's really a tough time to raise funds. We found that out with Kickstarter. It wasn't an easy process, even for the small amount. We really had to go out there, do a lot of emails, follow-up emails, phone calls, and that type of thing to really make sure the people who had wanted and expressed interest in pledging actually got to it. So we're hopeful within the next year we'll get that the full amount.
Well, Sarah, if this only raises a relatively small percentage of the total budget that you will need to really make the film, why not just aim for the sky and say, we need, I don't know, $150,000 and make that your Kickstarter goal?
Well, we can do that again. We can definitely try that. But for this period of time and what we needed, we felt that this was the best way to go. We had a definite goal of these are immediate items that we needed. We needed a website. We needed marketing materials. And we just wanted to create a goal and meet it rather than to get too big and not meet it and exceed it.
Well, let's talk a bit more about the film. You said that, you know, a lot of horror films are kind of bloody, there's gore, and your films don't have that. Is it hard to make a horror film without blood and guts?
No, not at all. I think when you set the mindset of those are things that you're not going to have in it, then you have to think of other alternatives. And I really look at the films of one, Alfred Hitchcock, and one of my favorite all-time films is The Haunting, but it's the 1963 version that Robert Wise directed. And when you have those basics, then it's not as hard to create something in that genre.
Even the most famous gory scene in a Hitchcock film, the stabbing in Psycho, isn't really that gory by modern standards.
No, because he made sure that the knife never penetrated the skin, and it played out in the audience's mind, which is the same goal that Robert Wise wanted to do with The Haunting.
Sarah, you're the writer, director. Paul, you are the production director and the art director?
Yes, production designer slash art director.
So quite a bit of the budget falls on you to be creative with, I guess.
Correct. I have to create the whole world in which the actors must live and also bring to life what the director has visualized for those actors to live in.
So what's this film going to look like, Gardner and Wells? It sounds like it could be in a Victorian mansion in Sacramento.
Well, actually, it's more of a Gothic story. So the building that we are looking at is actually a four-square house. So it's more Gothic, more heavy than a filigreed type of Victorian.
And Sarah, tell us what the story is about. It's kind of an odd title.
It is.
Sounds like a detective agency.
Well, the background is that our father is a retired Lutheran minister, and growing up, obviously, with being a minister, you do a lot of funerals, and the local funeral home was called Gerhardt and Wells. And so I took that growing up there and going there often. I actually took the name and made it Gardner and Wells. So Gardner and Wells is actually the funeral home, and there's two older sisters that run the funeral home. And it's basically based on the story of Mary and Martha in the Bible, of two different types of personalities. And these two sisters, one believes in the afterlife, the other doesn't. And it makes for a good conflict between that relationship.
The mission statement for Road Trip Films, your film company, mm-hmm. says, among other things, that you're going to develop films without the use of gratuitous language, sex, and violence. We mm-hmm. already talked about the fact that there's no need for gore in a horror film, mm-hmm. but that sounds like a broader aim that you have there. Why is that?
Well, I just don't feel that it's needed. Again, I come from the background of classic films where a wide audience can watch these films and over and over and over again, and they go back as far as, you know, something like Casablanca, which every time I watch that, it just, the meaning gets deeper and deeper, and it's something that lasts in our experience, and that basically is because I don't think the audience needs it. If you have a wider demographic, there's more people that can enjoy it. I think it's important for young people to enjoy movies along with older people, you know, and to have them come together and watch a movie together, and for it to last in our consciousness.
Paul, your employment background includes being a general contractor and designing custom houses,
right,
which sounds like it could be quite helpful for doing production design and art direction on a movie.
Very much so, because basically what you need to do in creating the sets to create the mood for the movie is that you have to design those, draft them, draw them up, give them over to someone to actually build them, and then you have to run the crew, you have to know the budget, you have to know the time constraints, and then there's certain things that need to be able to work in the cinema world. There has to be walls that need to fly or move in order for the camera to get where it needs to get. So you need to know all the insides, inside and outs of creating something that's specific for this medium.
When you say walls fly, you mean in the showbiz sense of the word, moving them out of the way, as opposed to in some magical sense of them flying off into
right,
the sky.
Right, exactly. You know, because sometimes walls or props or that type of thing need to be in an area to create the look of the room, but then the camera might have to get there too. So you're going to be able to move walls and put cameras in certain areas, so without disrupting the whole building.
Sarah, you said the two characters at the heart of Gardner and Wells are these two sisters who inherit a funeral home.
Mm-hmm.
And your earlier film, Elsa Letterseed, that had some success at film festivals, was about a child prodigy violin player who loses her gift, and
yes,
then she becomes an adult and she has to figure out what she's going to do differently.
Yes.
These sound like rather particular kinds of characters. Where do they come from?
Well, I really believe in character dramas. I love watching films that you invest into the characters and creating that world. And I think it's always more interesting when you're invested in the hero or heroine and you want them to make that journey. And the audience needs to go from point A to point B. And if you aren't invested in that main character, then the audience is less willing to go on that ride.
And if you are just looking to watch a film purely for entertainment, you're not watching an old film to study how it was made, how it was written, but just purely for pleasure, what kind of film would you go see or rent?
Oh, I always go back to The Birds. The Birds is my all-time favorite.
The Hitchcock one.
Yes, yes. If there's a choice, then I'm just going to pop that in because I just love watching it over and over and over
again.
What
do you like about it so much?
I think shot for shot, it's a masterpiece. I think every shot that he took was an important one. There's no waste in it. And there's several different lines of story in the movie itself. There's the romantic line. There is the conflict between Tippi Hedren, who I just met, actually. I was really excited about that. And Jessica
Tandy,
thank you. There's that conflict. There's obviously, then you have the horror of The Birds on top of it. So it's not just really a horror film. There are so many different layers within that movie.
And that, of course, is a scary film where no one gets ripped to pieces.
Right. Well, Tippi does at the end.
That's
but
true. That's true.
A little bit
yeah,
of blood, but it's not. But it's not gratuitous. I don't see it as gratuitous at all.
And Paul, are you a film buff?
Oh yes, very much so.
Same kind of movies.
Actually, I think I like dramas more. One of my favorite is Splendor in the Grass.
Oh.
And just a wonderful drama about, you know, interesting characters and how life is so different from what you plan it to be.
And finally, Sarah, and this is back to the fundraising that you successfully started for your new film, upcoming film, Gardner and Wells. I noticed on the Kickstarter page that you got at least one person who pledged $2,500. That's
yeah.
a lot of money.
Yeah, we're very grateful to them. That is a lot of money, so we better step up to the plate and do this right.
Well, we look forward to seeing the film when it gets made. It's Gardner and will be called Gardner and Wells, a Gothic ghost story. Joining us were the filmmakers Sarah Kreutz and Paul Kreutz. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
It's Insight from Capital Public Radio, coming up, the surprising history of artificial sweeteners. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Most of us know someone who tries to offset a big holiday season meal by following it with a diet soda or a coffee with saccharin. But how useful are artificial sweeteners? Are they harmful, as some people fear? A UC Davis professor is an expert on this. Carolyn de la Peña's new book is titled Empty Pleasures, the story of artificial sweeteners from saccharin to Splenda. When she joined us a few months ago, I asked why the first artificial sweetener was invented, to help people lose weight or for some other purpose.
Well, the first artificial sweetener was saccharin, and it was invented by accident in the 1870s, which is actually a common theme in artificial sweetener development. So it was while someone was working in a laboratory on actually a medicinal product, and one of the researchers, you know, licked a finger and discovered that it was sweet. And so from there was effort to develop saccharin for a market where it could be used in foods and beverages.
And at that point, when they discovered it by accident, what did they think it would be for? Just a more efficient substitute for sugar then, perhaps?
Yeah, so the idea early on, and this was something that Konstantin Fallberg did when he developed this product, was he thought that it was something that could be used to sweeten food products, that there was, in fact, a market that no one had discovered. And so he set about selling it, sold it in Europe and in Germany. And one of the people who had initially been sort of a sales rep for him with saccharin was actually John Queeny, who founded Monsanto. And Monsanto's one of its very first products was to make and sell saccharin for the American carbonated beverage market, as well as in canned foods. That wasn't something that consumers knew about. So it's one of the very interesting things about artificial sweeteners' history. It wasn't marketed to consumers first. In fact, it was put into foods because it was cheaper than sugar per part. You don't need to use as much. You can control it in the laboratory. It's not subject to volatile kinds of taxes or government shifts in places where sugar was manufactured and grown at the time.
So it was just sort of slipped into the food.
It was slipped into the food. And most Americans didn't know about artificial sweetener, and we're talking about saccharin right now, until the progressive era. You know, we're much more familiar with, say, the book The Jungle and sausages and contaminated meats. But saccharin was one of the things that was right up there in the American imagination. Sugar was healthful. Sugar was considered an important food, especially for children, a way to deliver cheap carbohydrates. And to remove sugar and put in its place this cheap adulterant, using the language of the time, that was completely unacceptable. So saccharin made a pretty swift exit from the American popular food market, although thanks to Teddy Roosevelt, who used it himself, it did get to stay on the market, and it wasn't subject to regulation, but it was only for diabetics and in medicinal bottles.
And when you say the progressive era, you're referring to the early 20th century.
Absolutely. So 1911, 1912, and you can follow these stories in the New York Times and the LA Times. And it didn't appear again until World War II.
So it was kind of like the corn syrup of the day.
Yes, it was. You know, and that's part of the history of sweets, is that, you know, there's often one sort of bad poster child for sweets. In that case, sugar was good, so saccharin was bad. Since then, it's been, you know, newer artificial sweeteners are good or promise in some ways to be better, and older artificial sweeteners are bad. Or now that sugar is bad or that corn syrup is bad. And one of the things I talk about in the book is the way that, you know, we come to these understandings in large part by the fact that sweetener companies often produce the kinds of research that then help us figure out what's good and what's bad, but also what makes profit for particular folks.
My guest is Carolyn de la Peña. She's professor of American Studies at UC Davis and author of the new book, Empty Pleasure, is the story of artificial sweeteners from saccharin to Splenda. Well, you said that saccharin was sort of stumbled upon by accident and then put into food as a sweetener, as a substitute for sugar, not for people to lose weight or anything, but just because it was a different way of sweetening things. But what was wrong with sugar? I mean, sugar is pretty cheap. It's widely available. Why even replace it?
Well, initially it was because you could control your product better when you use saccharin instead of sugar. And it's cheaper. So many of us don't realize that artificial sweeteners, so the ones we have on the market now, right, would be saccharin. And we have aspartame under the brand names of Equal and NutraSweet. We have sucralose, which goes by Splenda. And we did for a while have one called Cyclamate, which was taken off the market by the FDA in 1969. But all of those are quite a bit sweeter per part than table sugar. So between 200 times and 600 times sweeter.
You just don't need as much.
You don't need as much. And so in the early 20th century, although dieting goes back as far as really the 1920s with the rise of different fashion and a new vogue for slenderness, artificial sweetener was used by the food industry simply because it was intensely sweet. And that's one of the things we haven't focused on as much in our thoughts about artificial sweetener since then, that although it does remove calories, and that became sort of the mandate in the 1950s when it was branded in ways we're familiar with today for weight loss, but that at the same time, it's really shifted our sense of sweet.
So saccharin started out as a cheap substitute for sugar, but then people reacted against it. They didn't like this artificial thing being added to food instead of sugar. When did saccharin come back? And in particular, when did it come back as a diet aid? In other words, as a way to reduce calories?
I think there's two origin points, and both of them are important in understanding why artificial sweetener became such a normal way for us today to think about health and pursue healthy choices. One would be during World War II, of course, you know, sugar was rationed. It was difficult to get. There was a reason for American housewives to look for different kinds of substitutes. So saccharin was something that women began to experiment with, to literally go into the drugstore, pick it up in medicinal bottles and take it home and try to figure out how to use it.
And it was mainly women who were doing it.
And it was mainly women who did that. They had the responsibility for making food, for providing sweets. But you can also, one of the things where this project started for me was finding on eBay these little containers, these saccharin containers from the early 1950s, and they're sort of precious little jeweled objects. I'm sure some people remember these, saw them on their grandparents' shelves. And what you would do was, these were popular hostess gifts. So this was in the early 1950s and mid-1950s. You would sort of take these and you would give them to someone, so they had a way to hide those pill bottles and put the saccharin instead in something that could be passed around. And if you've ever held one, you see that it kind of forces you, and these would be women who were giving these gifts to each other, to really focus on yourself. It's hard to pick up the little pill. You have to put it into the drink. You have to hold the little tongs. And I think that was really important because, you know, sugar and sweetness had been a way to take care of your kids, to take care of soldiers during the war, to take care of your husband. And artificial sweeteners in that very early moment were a way that you could focus on yourself. So those kinds of messages that came out in the 1960s when we had the first diet sodas, like Tab, right? And you get that just for the taste of it, just for me, something that's for me alone. That really was something that women pursued on their own. But I should say that, you know, that's a small minority of consumers. Those saccharin in pills and in little containers would not have become the artificial sweetener industry we have today. For that, you have to look at pharmaceutical companies in the early 1950s who realized that they had a product on their hand, but not a market. And because the vogue of dieting was on the rise, and because people were becoming sort of distrustful of sugar for the same reasons they had loved sugar, right? It's easy calories, it's calories everywhere. Suddenly you had the proliferation of foods, cheap foods after World War II, and the advances in industry. So those foods were everywhere. Now there was actually a market to find a way to give people pleasurable products that didn't have those calories so that you could detach fun from energy and weight gain. So that's where you have these partnerships that develop between diet fruit manufacturers and pharmaceutical companies.
Carolyn de la Peña's book is Empty Pleasures, the story of artificial sweeteners from saccharin to Splenda. A lot of people have this feeling that artificial sweeteners are bad for you without necessarily having specific evidence. Are people right to be concerned?
Yes and no. You know, there's good reason why we're concerned. Many people will remember in 1977 there was what I call the saccharin rebellion, right, where the FDA, after banning cyclamates in 1969, decided that they would ban saccharin from the food supply because of something called the Delaney Clause that says, you know, carcinogens in any amount, you know, cannot be put into the food supply. And consumers really rebelled. This is one of the shocking things I found in my research. You know, rather than saying, thanks, FDA, for protecting us, they wrote letters, hundreds of thousands of people wrote letters to the president and to the FDA that basically said, you know, yeah, if I were a lab rat and yeah, if I ate a bathtub full of this stuff a day, then this might hurt me. But by the way, could you take care of my polluted air, my polluted water, my colleagues who are smoking in my face, the drunk drivers that I face, right? That people in the 70s really saw risks as facing them in all different corners of life. You know, why start with the one thing? This is their voice, right? The one thing that gives me pleasure. And so I think when you look, you can just do a quick internet search and you can see really more people probably are concerned about aspartame in particular than anything else, which has something to do with the process by which it was approved and conspiracy theories. But, you know, there's a sense that it's going to do something bad to us. But at the same time, you know, we want that sort of pleasure. One of the things I found when I did research on the stories about, you know, that it's caused headaches or dizziness or you know, a number of illnesses, was that when you kind of dig into those stories, you see people who are consuming 10 diet sodas a day. I mean, we're talking about vast amounts of artificial sweetener consumption. No. So, you know, I'm not a scientist. I do think probably anything in huge quantities like that has ill effects. But quite honestly, there's been so much effort on the part of one sweetener over another to kind of discredit others through research. If there were a sweetener out there that was causing cancer, I do think we would know.
Do artificial sweeteners actually help people lose weight? A lot of people feel like there's something virtuous about taking things with this artificial sweetener, but I've read that our body gets tricked by them, and we think we've got the sugar coming into our body, these calories, but they're not there, and so therefore it stimulates us to eat more somewhere else.
Yeah, as a historian, I'd go back to history just for a second before answering that now and say, you know, the very first people who really promoted artificial sweeteners were women. And it was people like the founder of Weight Watchers and women who were canners but realized they could have this much bigger market share by creating diet plans attached to their diet fruits or jellies or desserts. And created diet plans with them, you know, with these products and put it in newspapers in the 1950s that basically said, you know, you can have your sweets and you don't have to suffer. And there, one person in the artificial sweetener industry referred to this thing, it's a condition of prosperity stomach, in fact, that Americans have, right, too much food, it's too cheap, it's too plentiful. How in the world are we going to sell more of it, which is always the industry's mandate to sell more? And artificial sweetener was a tool so that you could fulfill your consumer appetite, which is being stoked by all of these advertising messages and the sense that food is an important place to find pleasure, right? And you could lose weight. So that's my caveat. Yes, artificial sweetener can help you lose weight. Of course, anytime you decrease the number of calories you take in, you're going to lose weight. But the questions that we've been asking about artificial sweetener, which are largely about, you know, does it cause cancer or is it natural, aren't the kinds of questions that I think after studying the history we ought to ask, where the question has to be, what does it do to us in the context of our everyday lives, right? Do we use it and then because it's sweet, we don't detect sweets as much in other parts of the food supply? Is there something about the taste of it that's detached from calories that doesn't satisfy cravings? And there has been research, especially in the last 5 to 7 years, on these questions, but we need more longitudinal studies. And I think it's alarming in a way that after really normalizing this in our food supply for going on 70 years now, we don't have an answer to that simple question.
Carolyn de la Peña, professor of American Studies at UC Davis. Her new book is Empty Pleasures, the Story of Artificial Sweeteners from Saccharin to Splenda. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
And that's Insight for today. Today's associate producer, Sosin Marar, Rosa Lee and Estevan Hernandez, the technical director, Mark Jones, the senior producer, Jen Picard. I'm Jeffrey Callison.